So I had this idea last year after meeting these fellows at last year's conference that there might be a lot of interest in having new authors formally get a little bit of some ideas from some seasoned authors. And if you are a new author, hearing from some seasoned authors. So I'd first like to try to find out how many of you consider yourselves seasoned authors. So. Well, you've done at least a first edition, probably more than that, or more than one book. So could put your hands up a little bit. Okay, so maybe half. So then the rest of you, are you interested in maybe writing a book? You're thinking about it. Maybe you have some of your manuscript ready. Okay, so that's great, because so it looks like we might have about 50-50, which is what I was ideally hoping for. Okay. So what we're going to do first is we're all going to introduce ourselves, and then I've got a few questions that I came up with for the panel, and then we're going to have the fun of having you come up with some questions for each other and for us. So she said, my name's Laura Frost. I'm from Florida Gulf Coast University, which is, if you follow basketball, that's Dunk City, and we're located in Fort Myers, Florida. And so one of the introductory remarks that I want everybody to answer up here is, how did you get interested in writing a textbook? And for me, it was I gave a presentation on the way that I was teaching the course, and I'm in chemistry, at a conference, and an acquisitions editor came up to me and said, hey, would you be interested in writing a book that uses that same approach? So that's how I got interested in writing a textbook. It's a chemistry textbook for an introductory course for allied health majors. I'm actually getting ready to publish a fourth edition, so I guess I'm in the seasoned classification. And then I asked everybody to come up with the top three things that they wish they would have known or have learned about textbook writing in the process. And so I did this too because I was thinking, well, I should tell you mine. The top three things I learned were, and many of you that know me will laugh at this one, you should know your co-author's work ethic. I also think that your publisher should be treated more as a partner, not as an adversary, because you need to understand their viewpoint as much as they understand your viewpoint so that you can come to agreement on things. And I also think that if you're writing a textbook, you ought to know as much as you can about pedagogy, because we don't need more textbooks that are just content. We need textbooks that can help students to learn the material. So those were my three things. And so with that, I'm going to pass it off to Brent, and he's going to give you his introduction.
All right. So my name is Brent Blair. And so I just have a series of questions I'm going to answer here. So I am from Xavier University in Cincinnati, Ohio. I first got interested in writing a textbook probably, you know, more than 10 years ago. I have taught environmental science for now maybe 13 years, 14 years in some form. And I guess I started really thinking seriously about it maybe 7 years ago when an acquisitions editor came to our university and was really asking me about if I was interested in writing an ecology textbook. So that's another course that I teach. And I really wasn't. That's not really my passion in a way. So I told him no, but he gave me his card and I continued to be interested. And so I hadn't gotten tenure at that point, so I really didn't think I had the time to pursue a textbook. But about 2 years ago, I started thinking about this again seriously, and I started putting together a chapter and a prospectus. And so I called the individual, the acquisitions editor from Oxford University Press, and we discussed, you know, potentially an environmental science textbook, and he was quite interested in it, and so it moved forward. So now I'm into it about a year after the contract was signed. I've written maybe four chapters out of 18, so it's a slow process, obviously, but it's coming along. Let's see. So, as I said, it's an environmental science textbook. Let's see if there's anything else here I need to tell you about. Okay, so the top three things I wish I had known, yes. And these are, they're all sort of circle around the same thing, or the top two do, but I would say they sort of relate to cycles and rhythms of writing. And one of the things that I wish I had known was sort of the cycle of my responsibility in terms of what I was doing. And at least in the process that I'm working through, is I have periods where I need to write a chapter or multiple chapters. I then send them off to review, but then when they come back, I have to revise the heck out of them. And, you know, often, you know, when I'm at the end of the first or second chapter that before I send them off to review, I'm really in a rhythm. And then when then editing starts, and that sort of slows me down, but then I get back into a rhythm of editing. But then there's a lot of waiting, you know, waiting for the reviewers to come back, and then also starting back with writing. So that's one thing I sort of wished I had known, that sort of cycle. Second thing is another cycle or rhythm of motivation in terms of how that cycle moves. And, you know, while I'm writing towards the end, I'm feeling really motivated, going very well, but when something new starts, I tend to sort of clam up in a sense, and it's much harder to get started, so that period. So just sort of the differences in motivation and ability, it's not that I'm not trying to write, not sitting in front of my computer, but just that I'm not able to do it as efficiently. And the third thing I guess I would say is that I wish I had known was just that when I created sort of the idea of this book, I thought I was going to be writing what I wanted to write in sort of my own, put my own ideas forward, and certainly I'm doing that, but it has to all sort of be, also I have to put forward what the buyers are going to want, and so my editors, you know, keep on reminding me that I need to, you know, we're looking at the competitors and seeing what they have and the reviewers and what they say they want. And of course, that mimics a lot of times what the competitors are saying. So in terms of just the scope of what needs to go into the book isn't as controlled by me as I had once thought it would be or wish it would be. But I'm rolling with it, and it's working out pretty well. let's see. And I think that's it for my intro. I'll hand it off.
If there's anything you would like the audience to consider that you need help on.
I'm sort of starting that process of writing again, and that motivation and just being able to focus really, have that sharp focus on what I'm doing is not going as well as I would like. So if anyone has any sort of tips or tricks for motivation, I've been asking a lot of people that during this period, and got a lot of good responses, but that would be my one question, I suppose.
Thanks, Brent. My name is Dave Dillon. I'm a professor and counseling faculty at Grossmont College in San Diego. And my interest in writing a textbook primarily came from two intersecting things. One was that I was an adjunct, this is about 2005, and working in four different community colleges at the same time. And so I found myself to be fortunate if I was landing at the right college at the right time on the right day to teach the right class. And, you know, my colleagues had teased me because I had this rolling bag of all of my materials from all these different places. And here comes Dave with his rolling bag and all his stuff. And I had a fair amount of my own original content. I had all kinds of Xerox things from all sorts of places. And then I would have either the assigned textbook that I was supposed to use from College X, and College Y gave me a list to be able to choose from. And so there was one particular semester in there where I came home and I was just exhausted, and there were too many materials to sift through. And I thought, if I ever become full time, gosh darn it, I'm going to write my own textbook and simplify, you know. And so that was part of the impetus. The other one was that I was teaching a class that I would say is kind of a niche class. It was a study skills and time management one unit course. And I just didn't find a whole lot of currently existing things that were specifically fitting that particular course. And so that's what I started to write. It was started in 2009. I had given myself a timeline of 2 years it took 5 years. And I'll allude a little bit to that later. I think that while I'm fiercely proud of the accomplishment, had I known what I was really getting myself into, I'm not entirely sure that I would have started. And so it was published 2014, and I've been approved for a sabbatical for the fall to be able to work on a second edition. Top three things I wish I would have known. So one is this association, and particularly this conference. So I serendipitously found this conference in 2015, and boy, it would have been valuable for me if I would have found it 2 or 3 years prior. The knowledge and insight and wisdom that the seasoned authors and the presenters have shared with me, both in presentations and personally one-on-one, has been absolutely invaluable. So big thank you to all of you. I have no doubt the second edition, because of some of that information that I received here, is going to make the textbook just a much better product. Secondly, the length, and for me, I've always been able to adhere to deadlines and get things done when they were supposed to. And so when I started this textbook and I started to miss deadlines, and that was primarily because my first daughter was born the same year that I started the project, and then my mother got sick, was diagnosed with dementia the next year. My second daughter was born the year after that. And so I had more than one publisher say, "Oh, that's okay, life happens." And I said, "No, you don't understand. Life doesn't happen to me. I get my things done." And I didn't. And for 2 years, I didn't write a single word. I was just not in the right place to be able to do that. So again, I'm very proud of that accomplishment. But the length was daunting, and it was something I wish I would have known, you know, in the beginning, how the magnitude of what I was taking on. I will also share that I think I took somewhat of an uncommon path. I had two contract offers in my journey, one from a Big Five publisher and one from a non-Big Five publisher, and they just didn't seem like the right fit for what I was trying to accomplish. And so I had politely declined and then went through some regret and then kind of found a blessing, I think, in disguise. I didn't know that there was a university press close to my campus, Montezuma Publishing on the San Diego State campus. They do formatting and binding and specialize in readers for professors. I was able to retain my copyright, which was very important to me. I certainly sacrificed the editing, marketing, advertising, but I'm very pleased. I've had the same manager for 8 years, which I know is not common for the textbook publishing world, and I'm very happy with that. And then the last thing I wish I would have known, just the general process about how acquisition and contracts work. And again, if I would have found TAA when I was going through that journey, I would have not second-guessed myself. I would have had Stephen review a contract and felt more confident about the whole thing. It's a final plug for TAA. This association and conference and people here have made so much difference to me. I appreciate you all.
I'm Rick Mullins, also from Xavier University. I'm in probably my third, fourth year working on a first edition organic chemistry textbook. I think the process for me, I kind of fell into writing a book. There was a time very early in my career that I confidently thought, hey, I have something to add, and writing a book would be a cool thing to do someday. But one discussion with an acquisition editor made me realize that it was never going to be. But I fortunately had this habit, and my wife wasn't working at the time, and so maybe that's what drives this. I had this habit of every email that offered a stipend for anything always got extra attention during my first 3 or 4 years. Of teaching, and so I would get opportunities to review textbooks, and they would offer a certain amount of money. And I, you know, feeling somewhat trying to be ethical about it, I felt like I should spend a certain amount of time. So there was one particular chapter I was reviewing for a proposed book, and I very quickly made my decision. Right, I knew what I wanted to say, but I felt like if I was getting paid this amount of money, I should spend 4 or 5 hours, was how much time I felt I should spend explaining myself. And so I was sitting, we were on vacation at the beach, and I was writing this explanation of why I wouldn't do it, and I would pick out individual paragraphs and say, hey, the author is saying this, my students wouldn't get it, they would need to have this said first, and then it would be this. And so in some ways, just filling that 5 hours of time that I felt like I was required to earn the money for doing this, that's what happened. And so then when they got it back, of course, and I don't know, maybe the acquisition editor at Pearson was really just trying to make a point to me that, hey, don't be so arrogant and condescending on our reviews, or else we're going to ask you to be an author. It's possible that that's what she was going for, but I called her bluff, and so here we are. I've written about 11 to 12 chapters of what will be a 24-chapter book. My hope is to finish it in the next year. I'm on sabbatical and will hopefully be able to, maybe next year I can be on a panel for new authors who have finished a draft of a book. Gets into the things that I wished I knew before starting is, I had this idea that writing a book was, you sit at a computer and you write a book and you just churn out chapter after chapter after chapter. The idea of development editors, acquisition editors, marketing managers, directors of development, all these different people involved in the process, really the idea that, 6 years to write a book, that just seems ridiculous. How could I be 3.5 years in and not quite halfway finished with the process? And that doesn't even include the production, which someday I'll wish I had known about what it takes to go through the final production stage. So it was that length of time, this idea that I'm kind of signing up for a second dissertation. I mean, who would spend 6 years getting a PhD again? Not me. But I'm doing something that takes a similar amount of time. So I was I wish I had known about that. But maybe they don't want you to know about that until you're 3 years in, when it's too late. The other thing that's happened as I'm sending out chapters for review is this idea that, I feel like I have something to add to the students, and my teaching style has meshed well with the students that I teach at Xavier, and I think I have things to share with them, and the market has backed that up. The challenge has been that's not the people who are selecting the book. So it's really an odd industry, and that we're writing a book that will be used by students and that will enable students to learn better, but they don't choose the book. And it's gone so far as to even have reviewers say, this, my students would like this book more. My students would learn from this book better than the one currently, but I would not adopt the book. And so how do you get past that barrier of writing for people who don't pick it? And I think there's obviously, the seasoned authors, I think that's one of the things that I would ask you is, how do you balance that? How do you break through that barrier to get it in the hands of the people that are truly going to benefit from it? The second thing, or the third thing, has been the struggle with, when you have an editorial team and they offer words of encouragement and they say things like, oh, trust me, this is a 6-year process, but it's going to be great and it's going to work out. And well, can you guarantee that it's going to get published at this point? Well, no, not yet. We can't make that guarantee. So there's this, and there's this conflict of, well, it's easy, but Rick, you should relax. Well, why should I relax? You guys are getting paid. I'm not getting paid yet. So it's this team of people that get paid and will be rewarded by their bosses if they cut bad projects. Whereas I don't get rewarded if I'm the bad project that gets cut. So I think that has been, sort of an undue, it's a stressful thing. We just had lunch with my acquisition editor, and she alluded to me as an emotional author. I can own that, but it's not a, I'd love to see a detached, non-emotional author.
So These three gentlemen have come up with some questions that they would like answers to, and I wanted to ask them questions and then open up the questions or answers to the audience. So here's the first one. You've been under contract for a certain number of years, and how many editors have you worked with as your primary contact?
So I had one acquisition editor, and he actually was around 8 years ago when he first contacted me. So he's been at the company, Oxford University Press, for quite some time. However, I have had two developmental editors, and that sort of, yeah, that was a little challenging, that transition.
Again, uncommon path. Yeah. I am not under contract, and while that scares me sometimes, so far it's been a really good working relationship. I hired my own editor, so it came out of and continues to come out of my pocket, but I've had the same editor and the same manager for 8 years.
I guess my story is different. The editor who acquired me was promoted after the first year, was promoted to editor-in-chief, which is good that she's still involved in the project and in some ways has a little bit more power over the project. But since then, so we count her, and then I've had two others, so a total of three acquisition editors. And I guess I was only acquired by one. That's, you know, the terminology and who these people are on the team. That's another thing I've always struggled with, is who's who. But three people that are in that role of acquisition editor. Fortunately, I've only had one development editor who I'm working with most often, and she's incredible. So that's worked out.
Would anyone in the audience like to tell us how many editors they've had?
Because of mergers, I've had five owners and 14 editors.
And over how many years?
First edition came out 25 years ago, 1992.
Okay.
A book adopted me, I'll put it that way. So I came in as the third author, single editor. And when I came in, the first acquisition editor I had on two editions. And I had one on the third edition. And on this fourth edition, I have gone through three acquisition editors.
Right.
And the one thing I can say is the thing is so important is that you make these ridiculously long files in your emails, because when that third editor comes in and says, I have no idea, there are no records, then you can go back and you can say, 2.5 years ago, this email was sent to me and I'm now going to send it to you. Please copy it and put it in a file so that you do have a concrete copy of this.
Okay, we're going to move on to the next question. Did you have a lawyer review your first contract? Do you wish you would have? Why or why not?
The answer to that is yes, and it was actually Steve over here. And I'm very happy I did. The publisher basically came to me and said, okay, well, you know, this is just a standard template. You know, it never changes. We're just going to send it to you. You sign it and send it back to us. You know, FedEx it back to us. And I was like, hey, wait, you know, I want to take a look at this contract before I sign it, because they hadn't even sent me a copy of the contract, you know, a PDF or anything. And so they seemed to feel that was a little odd, but they said, okay. And so they sent me just a completely blank template with a bunch of, you know, a bunch of legalese on it. They didn't have any of the parts filled out. You know, they didn't have my name, but they didn't have, you know, my, you know, the percent I was going to get or anything. And I'm like, you know, that's really not what I was thinking. And at that point, I think I was already planning to hire someone or hire Steve. I had sort of done a little homework. And my dad was an attorney also, and so, you know, his philosophy would be never to sign a contract without an attorney. So I proceeded to contact him, and he then sort of represented me through the process. But it was a long and, I would say, arduous process, and he would probably back me up on that if he remembers that. And they were really kind of, I would say, belligerent, and they really did have this philosophy like, well, this is what it's always like. So I'm very glad that I hired an attorney for that and would recommend it to anyone, regardless of how nice your acquisition editor seems, because certainly they talk a good game. So,
very early on in my process, there was an acquisition editor that had taken me out to dinner, And at the time, I only had a table of contents and a draft chapter. And much to my surprise, right after dessert, a contract appeared on the table. And you know, there was this a little eerie pressure to sign it on the spot. And so I said something like, "Thank you. I'm really interested in this potential opportunity, and I would like to think about it." And you would have thought that I killed this person's dog, because that was clearly not the answer that was expected. So I was sharing with Steve last night that same story, and he said, "Well, what month was that?" And I said, "It was around December." And he said, "Well, that's why." So, you know, I got the impression, and I had a feeling at the time. It didn't have a whole lot to do with me or my work. It had to do with trying to get a contract done. So the easy answer is yes, I absolutely would have liked a lawyer to, you know, I never signed it. I think it would have been valuable for me solely from not feeling like I was going to regret passing up on this opportunity, because at the time I was thinking, oh, did I make a mistake? Is this opportunity ever going to come again? And so I'm glad that I didn't sign the typical boilerplate contract, because when I got to TAA, it was like, of course you shouldn't sign that one. There's all this negotiation that should take place, but they don't tell you that.
So I was, I guess, naive about the process. I do have a friend who's an attorney, not in publishing law, and I had him read it for just sort of the, you know, do I know what I'm signing? And there were a couple of things he said, "Now you realize this is saying this." And we did have one thing that, and I don't remember at this point, that we went back and asked to be changed, and oh yeah, well, we'll take care of that, and it was fixed. So I would put myself in the category of not having a formal review by a lawyer. At this point, I would say from coming to these TAA meetings, I probably regret it, but I don't yet know why I regret it, so.
Okay, would anyone in the audience like to tell us if they ever had a lawyer review their first contract? Do you wish you would have?
So Dave, I received my first contract on December 23rd. And I thought, well, it would be a good idea to have a lawyer look at it. So immediately after Christmas, I made an appointment with my just family lawyer, and he had no clue. Bless his heart, love him, great guy. He'll write a will for you, do a great job. He had no clue about the publishing industry. I didn't know people like Steve existed, and so I signed away things that I should have never signed away. Just having that same emotion of, oh, if I don't sign, this might be my only shot.
Okay, we're going to move on to the next question. Are you overall happy with your publisher? Why or why not?
Yes. So like I said, I don't have a reason to wish I had had a lawyer read it yet. I think I would say I wish the process were moving more quickly. I get the sense that, you know, in a lot of ways you just have to trust that there's a process and that they know the process. Pearson has published a book or two in their lives. They know how to do it. And so this is what everybody tells me when I'm freaking out about it, is they know what they're doing. And so I'm happy in that regard. I do wish we were moving more quickly, but I don't know how it would be different if I were with anybody else. So I'm very happy with it.
I'm very happy with mine. I certainly realize the liability not being under contract. And as I was saying, I don't have the editing or the marketing assistance pieces, but I'm very happy because I maintain my copyright. My publisher is extremely responsive, communicates very well. I know that there aren't competing authors in my niche with with my publisher, so that's a big deal to me. And I have creative control over every aspect. So it's nice to be able to pick the cover design and have the layout the way that I want it to be. It's also completely on me when there's a word that's misspelled, because I'm the one.
I would say overall that I'm actually quite happy. The one sort of glitch, I think, was when we transferred from one developmental editor to the next, and I wasn't really kept in the loop in terms of what was going on. It turns out the first one was pregnant, and so she just sort of disappeared. And the company knew that, I didn't though. And so that sort of slowed things down, and you know, I was waiting for getting a review back from her, and or just, you know, for her to edit a couple of chapters, and then I find out they've already sent it out to review to reviewers without getting any added editing, which was sort of annoying. Now it's working a lot more smoothly, but yeah, that was a little glitch. But overall, I'm quite happy though.
Okay, audience, this is your chance. Are you overall happy with your publisher? Why or why not? Anyone else like to share on that one? Okay, thank you. Okay, we have one more question before we get some more interaction from you. What electronic programs for organizing your writing have you been using to assist you with your writing?
Okay. I guess I use several. One thing, obviously, you know, Word is where everything ends up. I actually use a program called Ulysses when I'm doing my initial draft, and there's something else that's similar called Scrivener. I'm not sure if these are Mac only or if they're available. Are they? But I really like Ulysses because it allows you to sort of break up sections of chapters. So I have, you know, each chapter, but then I have that the entire book, then each chapter broken down, and then within each chapter, different little sections of each section within a chapter, and I can just sort of click on it, that pops up, and I can just edit that. If I want to move sections around, I can shift those around quite easily, much more fluidly and easily than I could do so in Word. So in that way, I like it. Eventually, I have to port it all over to Word for the publisher, but for me, that it's worked really well. What else do I use? For graphics, you know, flow charts and other graphics, I used OmniGraffle, which is a program that's, again, it might only be for Mac, but I've found very, very useful for really all sorts of graphic figures and things like that in my for my text. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. Those are the big ones that I think might be a little unusual compared to the standard.
OmniGraffle. Graffle.
Yeah.
I'm going to try it.
All right. Yeah.
Dropbox is my go-to for organization. I've been experimenting a little bit with Dragon voice dictating software, and I find that either certain moods or certain days or I think just the context that I'm thinking about delivering flows in a different way if I'm speaking than if I'm trying to write or type. Mm-hmm. And so I do notice that I have to come back and spend some more time editing what I speak, but I'm pleased with how the words sit on the page sometimes when I'm speaking. And then not an electronic resource, but shout out to Kevin, because last year he had talked about a standing desk, and it's been my mission to try to get my college to get me a standing desk, which is kind of like trying to get a publisher to change the contract, I think. but I did have success a week ago. My standing desk was installed in my office, so I'm looking forward to using that.
Similar to Kevin, although I got a sitting standing desk because apparently just standing is now a problem, right? Sitting is bad. It was too late. So organic chemistry is very drawing intensive, structure intensive. So for that, I use a program called ChemDraw. One of the things that I do to save time, drawing the structures into ChemDraw, I found interrupts the flow of my writing. And so that I can write more quickly, I use a bamboo tablet with a program called SmoothDraw. I sketch them out, put them in as place fillers, and the university, Xavier has, and even Pearson has supported at multiple times, paying for student assistants to render those pictures into ChemDraw. So it's been, you know, the programs are great, but I think it's also been very nice having students directly involved in the project through that way, them taking my pictures, converting them to ChemDraw, and very often saying, hey, wait a second, this doesn't look like what we learned. Are you sure you drew this correctly? So there's that sort of editorial piece that's in there. But for the most part, Microsoft Word, ChemDraw, the smooth draw with the bamboo tablet, and then transferring files either through Dropbox or OneDrive.
I'm sure you have some things that you use that are might be useful to others in the room.
First off, I just want to mention I use Scrivener as well, and it is recently available for Windows as well. I don't know about Ulysses. I also use Microsoft OneNote, which is like a notebook system where you can organize files. And so what I'll do is, you know, you can have a notebook, and you can have sections, and you can have pages within the section. And so that's a way for me to kind of collect information and notes before I make a draft. So actually, every time a book comes out, I create a new section, which is for the revision. And then when I'm on the web and I'm like, oh, there's this thing that I'm going to need to refer to next time, I just go ahead and save a link to that OneNote notebook so that when I dig in for the revision, I have all this material here waiting for me.
One of the things that saved my life came from Robert. 10, 15 years ago, I used two monitors, and I can move my material back and forth so I can look at reviews. I don't have to toggle, which drives me crazy anytime on one computer, but two monitors is beautiful to use.
Any other tricks, programs? Okay, so what we'd like to do now is try to get each table, so see, if you're sitting at a table with just two people, we're going to try to combine you and have both seasoned authors and if you consider yourself a new author sitting at the same table together, and I'm going to give you different questionnaires to fill out. Because we thought of some things we wanted to know, and we would like you to fill these out, and then we'll share them with you. Some of the new authors might have some questions, so if you have questions, you can put them on these sheets, and then we'll try to go through some of these. So, well, I think in the interest of time, it might make more sense for me to just read some of your comments. So, one of the questions that was on the seasoned, author sheet, did I get them all? Oh, okay. Which I was interested in, and I think everybody gets interested in, you know, how do we stay motivated? So, you know, a seasoned author must regularly stay motivated. So that was one of the questions on the yellow sheets. One of the answers from you was, I like writing the material. It was a great and it was a new and interesting experience and a great opportunity. So that motivated one of you. I promised a manuscript and then had no choice but to deliver. How do you stay motivated? I work in chunks and make small accomplishments. So you get those small, make the small goals. Don't think about the big ones.
Laura, can we interrupt with a question?
Sure.
Go ahead. Along those lines, and we were just having this conversation up here, that in the early, when I was creating new draft chapters for the first time, I'm a competitive person, and so I had this scoreboard in my head of words written, and every day I would, you know, give myself a gold star if I had written X number of words. And that works really well for generating new content. Even had a spreadsheet with the number of every word I had ever written. But then editing, I'm turning a 20,000 word chapter into a 12,000 word chapter. By my scoreboard, I'm going in reverse, and I'm acknowledging that I wasted time writing those 8,000 words. How do you set goals for editing, right? I mean, because you're chipping away at it.
Anybody wanna?
You cut it and you put it away because you wrote it and it could go someplace else. And so you're not really destroying what you wrote. You're just putting it in a new book that's never going to be published or something.
But then, you know, because that's what I found going through the cycles is when they said, okay, we need you to reduce because textbooks are too expensive. Now we want you to go from 700 to 20 down to 600 And 80, it's like, oh, this is my new challenge. What can I get rid of? What's nice to know? And that becomes an ancillary.
Got a couple more comments on that.
There's nothing wrong with producing ore. You're describing a mining process where you're looking for the gold. And if you've got a strong outline, you've got strong topic sentences derived from the H1, H2, H3 headings in the outline, you have your list of key terms set out in advance, key artwork already done, and you find that ore in there. But, that focus helps glean out the extra wordiness, or reading it out loud in the editing process, but not doing it on screen. Doing it from printed copy. I know we all use computers, but that printed copy is ingrained in us that we're born, say, before whatever. But
so it's much harder and takes much more time to write short than to write long. And writing long that's not the end of the process. It's just a step along the way. So it's fine to count words, but that's not the measure of the value of what you've written.
Yeah, I just have a different analogy, and that is gardening. You know, you plant a bunch of stuff, but if you leave it all go and try to nurture all those, they'll all die. You have to weed them out. So that's stuff that you're weeding out. So it might even benefit you to be conscious of that when you're doing the long writing, is that, okay, this is just the first step in the process, and realize that you're not really wasting your time. You're setting out your ideas, and you know, as you know, and everything in life, you have all these different ideas, and you eventually have to weed them out and find one path.
I'm not as seasoned as any of these guys, but I'll just say that I find sometimes just counting how many pages I cleaned out, like the weeding concept, that gives me like a sense of, okay, this is clean. I'm done. I may have to redo it again.
When I have a very large project like this, a textbook, rather than working in pages or number of words, I always use what's called the Pomodoro method, maybe some of you know it, where you work in 25-minute blocks, and you set a timer, you turn everything else off, and you just write. And they actually have done a lot of research on what works, and they say you do 4 of these sessions with 5-minute breaks in between each one, then you give yourself a 15-minute break. I'm not, you know, as fanatic about those exact number of minutes, but I do set a daily goal for how many minutes I plan to spend writing each day, depending on whether or not it's a teaching day or a non-teaching day. And that really works well for me, so I feel like I've made progress, you know, just in time rather than in words.
Thank you.
I just plan to throw out a certain percent of what I do. I mean, I've taught writing to students, and one time I brought in a couple versions of a manuscript for a unit just to tell them, to show them what ended up and how many pages, you know, just didn't really work out like I thought that they would, because that's what I would tell them to do in the writing class. Like, don't, you know, sometimes you have to throw away stuff, and don't be afraid of that.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to go to some of the questions on the new author sheet. This one kind of looked interesting to me. Is it worth it? How much do you hope to make? And are advances typical? I'm going to answer the is it worth it part for myself. Is when I started teaching the course that I have the textbook in, I taught it in a different way, and I was reaching 48 students in a section. And when I decided to write the textbook, I thought, well, I could be reaching many more students by doing it this way. And so to me, it was worth it, because now I can reach thousands of students and help them to learn the material than just the 48 in my own classroom.
Avoid the institutional reason for being there. It'll happen. Like, if the students are there to get a grade and I'm there to get paid, we're going to have this grade pay thing that administrators control, and nothing's going to happen. But if they're there for thinking and learning the process of behavioral change, the pay and the grade, unless there's trickery, will take place. But we got to do the thinking and learning. So writing for the royalty check That doesn't work. That you can tickle yourself for an hour and then you're done. I mean, make it be, the purpose is to be a better student of your own topic, thinking and learning within yourself, reaching a larger classroom, changing the world.
Yeah, there's a bit of altruism in being a textbook author, I would say. Oh. Okay, here's another one. How do you find balance between work and your personal life? Is there balance? Would anyone like to, the seasoned authors, like to answer that? Oh, good. We have a brave.
So I have this tendency that maybe some of you can relate to, where if there's more things to do, then somehow they just have to fit. And then I end up getting little sleep, or, you know, just everything goes haywire. And it's actually my husband who has pointed out to me enough times that it started to sink in that that there's a limited amount of space and you have to make decisions. And so I've started trying to practice that skill of trying to soberly look at what's on my plate and think about what needs to move off of that rather than how to shoehorn one more thing in.
Here's another one. When and how do you develop supplemental materials and an instructor's manual and the exercises? I would say all that comes after the textbook itself. Some of the exercises you would be doing, I guess, at the end of chapters.
I've learned, take notes as you're going along.
Yeah.
And then if there's something that you think, you know, maybe it would be a great extra activity, like keep a set of notes along with your chapter. And then also that stuff that you can't use, you can copy that into your notes. But it's a lot easier than going back at the end and trying to recreate what you were thinking.
The idea of on the fly, like you have that glossary document, you have the instructor's manual document, you even can have a test bank document, and you're constantly on the fly dropping in there so you don't come down to the end and have to sit there for 2 weeks
making
and type
notes.
Up 700-word glossary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a good one. How did you know you had something to say or to share that other people would be, you know, want to read?
I think that's kind of already been mentioned, and that is you're already using materials when you start teaching that you find dissatisfactory because they don't fit the way you teach, or they don't fit your students, or both, or you've thought of a clearer way or more effective way or whatever. And so you get that itch, that urge to like, well, I can fix this.
Okay, so here's another one from a new author. I'm finishing year 4 of 6. Do I wait until after the tenure decision, or do I begin now?
Can I maybe give an answer? And maybe this is naive, but in my experience at Xavier, when I was writing a book, now it wasn't as critical as the tenure process, but it was for the promotion process of, you know, should I be working on a book until I get promoted to professor? And I think the way I rationalized it was that if you're at an institution who believes that what you should be doing is also what you believe you should be doing, then go for it. Because in some ways, and I know for somebody that gets denied tenure, this never would sound like consolation, but to be denied tenure for doing what is your passion and what you believe is their passion means you're at the wrong place. And you might end up in that place where you're, for my promotion to professor, the application, I made the case that the book is valuable. It's more valuable than research articles because it's what we do. It has bigger impact. It has all this. And, you know, after applying, I still would have given myself maybe a 30% chance of getting promoted. But it ended up working. And so I think if you choose that path, just make sure that you can justify it in the context of the tenure requirements of your university. The people that you're writing to, they understand, right? There are guidelines, but I think if you can passionately make the case for why what you're doing is more valuable than these other things that you're ignoring, then I think it can work out.
Along those lines, it's just that it takes a lot longer to write a textbook than it does an article, and sometimes quantity matters. This is something I heard in another session, but quantity matters. So if that's all you're going to be able to do, you might want to consider doing the articles rather than the...
But I really thank you for your input on the session And I thank the panel for agreeing when I, you know, sent them the email, hey, we should do this, and I kept bugging them for agreeing to come to the meeting this year and participating. So thank you.
Let's give the panel a hand. Yeah.